everybody. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host, as usual, and I'm here with Andy Steiger today.
Present.
All right. That's quite the mug you got there, Andy.
Thank you. This has been making the rounds on Facebook lately. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually think it would get that much attention. It's a unicorn mug.
Yeah.
Steve.
Is it a rainbow that I see coming out of its bum?
That is, actually. This. If you haven't seen it, we'll post a picture, but it's truly spectacular. It is a mug with a unicorn coming out of it, and it's the unicorn's tail is its like handle.
Wow.
It's something else.
But that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I was on vacation and went down to my stomping grounds in Portland, Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and swam through some books at Powell's Bookstore and worked my mm-hmm. way to the store called Fuego.
Fuego.
And they had all kinds of fun stuff there, and I saw this unicorn mug and I knew I needed to own it.
Well, there you have it, folks. Whenever you're down in Portland, Oregon, that's one stop you need to make.
You really do.
Fuego.
Or, there's a website, actually, that it's called thinkgeek.com.
Thinkgeek.com.
It's worth some perusing.
How was your vacation, by the way?
It's fantastic.
You were gone
man.
For a couple weeks.
Yeah, I was gone for 2 weeks. Did a little staycation and did some work around the house. Yeah, and mm-hmm. shot on down to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't know, I was born in California, but I mm-hmm. lived most of my life in Portland before I came up to British Columbia mm-hmm. to go to college.
Yeah.
Found a Canadian girl and haven't left.
Mm-hmm. So. You've been here quite a while now, haven't you?
You know what's creepy, man? I've almost lived in Canada as long as I've been a U.S. citizen. So I'm in like a major identity crisis here. Like, yeah, because it's almost 19 years now.
Mm.
I was 19, 20 when I came up to Canada.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's a little creepy.
Yeah, I can appreciate that feeling because, I came here when I was 14, so I've been here well over half my life now, but right around that halfway point, I was thinking, oh, man, you know, like, yeah, what am I? Yeah, nice. Well, before we get into things, just a couple of quick announcements about the Thinking Series. The first one is the Thinking Series online course. We're going to be offering it again this fall 2016. The registration is open now, so you can go to our website, apologeticscanada.com, and you'll see a banner there. You can click on that and go there, or you can simply type in thinkingseriescourse.com. And if you don't have an account with us, you can simply create one and start taking it. You can take it for free, or you can take it for a certificate.
Yeah, last year we had 200 people take it for free.
Yeah, lots of people.
Lots of people. We'd love for you to take it. Mm-hmm. Tell a friend about it.
Yeah, for sure. And if you take it for a certificate, your assignments will be graded and commented on by us. So you'll have a chance to interact with us that way. The second one is the Thinking Series website, thinkingseries.com.
It's been updated.
Yeah.
It's looking good, Steve.
Yeah. Andy took advantage of some cheap Asian labor here, and we updated it. At the bottom of the main page, you will see a little section called Thinking Series Near You.
We're excited about this.
Yeah. This is where you'll see some of the Thinking Series that are happening around you. Hopefully. There's actually a form that you can fill in. It only takes a couple minutes to fill in. When you do that, you are basically letting us know when and where you'll be hosting the Thinking Series, so then we can put it up on the website, and then we can let others know that way. In fact, this one church from Racine, Wisconsin, contacted us, letting us know that they will be hosting the Thinking Series.
Yeah, we're continually amazed mm-hmm. at where it's being hosted. So
check us out there at thinkingseries.com. Andy, you brought an article with you.
I did. We're going to jump into things here. We want to talk about chatbots today and see where that conversation mm-hmm. leads us. As many of you know, we kind of mined for different resources to what we're going to discuss. And I was looking through Bloomberg's Business Week. This is one of the magazines that I have a subscription to, mm-hmm. although I recently canceled it because I haven't really found it to be all that helpful. But this is like one of the few remaining episode, magazines that I'm going to be getting before my subscription is done. And all of a sudden I get something relevant here mm-hmm. that I thought was interesting. It's an article on chatbots, and the title is called The Humans Hiding Behind the Chatbots. And this is something that we're hearing more and more about, and I'm bringing it up because I'm telling you, you're going to hear more mm-hmm. about these chatbots if you haven't already. One of the parts of the article was the fact that over $50 million has been invested into startups that have been doing this kind of stuff, anywhere from startups like Magic, Facebook's M. If you haven't checked that out, you can go take a look at that, and GoButler. And mainly, it seems to me from a lot of these resources, as we've been looking at them, that they're these resources that are kind of like these virtual assistants.
Yeah.
And one of the main ones, and this is what the article was on, is X.AI.
Yeah, I actually checked it out yesterday, and it's fascinating. X.AI is basically a virtual assistant of a sort. So how it works is, let's say if I want to book an appointment with Andy. So, we're exchanging emails. What I would do is, as I'm sending Andy an email, I would CC X.AI. Or actually, they even named their artificial intelligence assistant. And the name is Amy. So you basically CC Amy and say, hey, Amy, could you book an appointment for me with Andy? Then what happens is this virtual assistant, Amy, will start having a conversation with Andy and say, hey, Steve is available these times, what works for you? Andy might reply back to Amy and say, well, 4 p.m. on this day doesn't work, but how about, 7 p.m. on this day? And then Amy will reply back and say, okay, 7 p.m. on such and such a day, and we'll see you there, kind of a thing. And then it just books the books an appointment. So you don't have to spend time exchanging emails back and forth to arrange these things.
You have a virtual assistant that does it. Well, it's interesting because the Facebook M, if you haven't checked that one out, you can see that. I don't know if that's available actually for people, but there's articles about it. Yeah. I think it's only available for a select group that's kind of
probably doing some
beta
kind of
testing.
But
it'll make reservations for you, like even reserve. I think it'll even do flights and reserve a hotel or whatever. Does a number of things. I think even restaurant bookings. I'm not quite sure how that all works. However, because you're like, man, how can a virtual assistant do that? And that's a good question. In fact, the article is about that very thing. Is the virtual assistant actually doing it? And as you could tell from the title, the humans hiding behind the chatbots. What they're working on right now is we're in a culture right now that's in a race to try to develop artificial intelligence applications, and in doing that, they're just the technology is not quite there yet. And so, what is happening is there's humans actually behind it that are making it happen, and so everywhere, anything from letting the programs know when they're not doing something right to helping them solve problems. Like apparently, one of the problems that comes up seems like a major problem is how to understand the word tomorrow, for example.
Right.
That word's used in a lot of different contexts, and and it can be really confusing for a program to know what's the appropriate context. And so the human has to step in and kind of guide that. But this is kind of what's developing these new services. And we've brought this up, I think, in a podcast a while ago where we talked about chatbots because Microsoft was having issues with their chatbots. Now, these chatbots we were just talking about, these are kind of virtual assistants. But there's another type of chatbot where, it's supposed to be kind of like an artificial friend, if you will, you can have a conversation with.
And I believe Microsoft's chatbot, what was its name? I forget what it was.
Well, I'm not sure. Their virtual assistant is Cortana. Yeah, Cortana.
Yeah. But anyway, apparently this chatbot, basically what it does is it would scour the internet and start learning how people talk, and then it would kind of emulate that. But then this, I guess we're all a bunch of racists and bigots and whatever, because
it was susceptible to suggestions.
Yeah. And then it would start saying all these really offensive things, and so Microsoft quickly shut it down. Issued an apology, and they were working on it. I'm not sure if it's back up again.
See, because that's the challenge, right? When the strings aren't attached to these programs. If you think about like a program like Siri, for the most part, anytime you ask Siri a question, they're pre-programmed responses. Which, by the way, if you're just bored, you don't have anything to do. You could ask Siri, to beatbox, for example, and you'll see what it'll do. Or, do you know any others? that you can? There's a couple others. I'm forgetting. Yeah. My son knows them all. He thinks they're hilarious.
Of course he would.
But there's some other ones out recently that we just saw that we should probably, like, maybe we should even ask some questions of. There's a Donald.
Yeah.
A Donald Trump chatbot.
Yeah, there are a number of them out there. And I found one that was a little bit kind of, this one's not as advanced, but basically what it does is if you ask it a question or anything really, it'll just spit out a random response. And some of them can be pretty funny. And
so I think what some of these are doing, particularly the Donald one, mm-hmm. is they've kind of taken any speeches he's given
right.
or any quips or tweets.
And so it will kind of piece it together. Yeah. To form a response, and it and some of the more advanced ones, they sound pretty convincing. Some of them.
What did you've got a couple here that you've
yeah, done? I brought up this one called Trump Bot, and I asked it a bunch of questions multiple times, and I've found some pretty interesting combinations of questions and answers, if you will. I asked, this is a little bit close to my heart. I asked this Trump bot, do you actually plan to withdraw the U.S. troops from South Korea? And Donald Trump bot responded by saying, I will do much better. And I'm like, okay. Well,
that's probably
that
as
kinda,
deep as you probably yeah. gotten anyways.
Yeah. Well, actually, the article that this was embedded in, I was saying, actually, one good thing about this Trump bot is that this one will always give you an answer and never avoid your questions. And then I asked again, do you believe in God? And it said, we get along with China. Like, okay, apparently God okay. is a fan of China.
Okay.
Okay, and then I asked, have you heard of Apologetics Canada? The response was, we'll have a wall.
Okay. Not sure how to take that. That doesn't sound good to me.
Yeah. Apparently a wall is like his answer to everything. Finally, I asked him, Have you read Andy's book? And his response was, this is a mess.
Well, I've heard that one before. It sounds like he's been talking to my wife.
Yeah, so, and then there are some of the
that's hilarious, man.
There are some of the more advanced ones like Deep Drump, developed by these guys at MIT, that actually has a Twitter account. So you can look it up, at Deep Drump, so D-R-U-M-P-F. If you've watched John Oliver's show or whatever, you know the reference. And one time, let's see, Fox News said something here a while ago. Fox News was quoting Ted Cruz as saying, every candidate talks about economic growth, but I'm the only candidate with a real concrete policy solution. To which Deep Drump, I guess just randomly, replied, because I don't think it replies to every single tweet from other Twitter accounts, but this one engaged with Fox News and said, I have a hard time with inner cities. It's a serious problem. I will build a great, great wall. It's a financial statement.
Okay.
Okay. And then the Twitter account from Hillary Clinton, so real Hillary Clinton, her Twitter account said, she was quoting Donald Trump here. It says, quote, I love Hispanics, end quote. Trump, 52 minutes ago. And then next line, it says, quote, they're going to be deported, end quote. Trump, yesterday. To which Deep Drump replied, I can destroy a man's life by firing him over the wall. That's always been what I'm running. To kill people and create jobs.
Oh, jeez.
I'm like, I can almost hear him say, "You're fired." But anyway, some
so
of them
I guess
are
that's the entertainment, I guess, with these chatbots are, you know, I guess when people are super bored and have nothing better to do than to, entertain themselves with artificial intelligence. But I mean, that's the question, you know, how intelligent does that actually sound?
Mm.
Well. Because I mean, we've talked about this before. What actually classifies as artificial intelligence?
Mm-hmm.
This has been a major question of debate, and in fact, this is one of the major questions that's coming up in these articles. And I'm seeing more and more of these coming about, mm-hmm. particularly with these chatbots that have to do with how are we to understand this whole artificial intelligence thing?
Yeah, I guess in a sense, if you think about it, for those of us maybe who are not you know, for whom this is like the first encounter with artificial intelligence or the issues thereof, I'm thinking, you know, if you just have input-output sort of a thing, like you would with a calculator, you know, you enter 2 plus 2 and then you get 4, you wouldn't necessarily count that as intelligence, right? But at what point does it get, at what point of complexity or whatever does it become an intelligence? I guess that's the question.
Now, for a long time, the kind of litmus test that, okay, this is something is intelligent is if it could pass the Turing test. Now, Alan Turing came up with this idea of really of the original chatbot, which said if you could be in a conversation with, you know, your computer, whatever it is, or the cloud, some program, and you're chatting back and forth, and at the end of that conversation, you don't know, and that that doesn't have to be a verbal conversation. It could be a text conversation, but at the end of that conversation, you don't know whether or not it's a person on the other end or artificial intelligence, which by the way is interesting because the article's saying, well, most often when you're using these services, it's actually a person on the other end. But at the end of the time, if you can't tell, then for a long time it was believed, well, then you could say that it was intelligent.
Yeah, intelligent and a person at that.
Right. Now, that's the big thing, right? Because, I mean, there's two forms of artificial intelligence. There's a weak form and then there's a strong form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the strong form would say, well, it's actually a person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the more advanced technology gets and these programs and these chatbots become, we've become to start to wonder and realize that perhaps that test isn't quite adequate. I mean, in some ways, it's a very subjective test because you're saying that you think that you were talking with a person where somebody else might go, no.
Oh, that was a total machine.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's even like with these Donald quotes. I mean, some people might go, oh, yeah, that totally sounds like Donald or whatever. And other people are like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, that sounds doesn't like sound anything like him.
Yeah, it just sounds like, you know, the program's grabbing random, you know, phrases here and there and responding.
Yeah.
So what you've been seeing is you know, in our culture right now is a real dialogue about, okay, what does it mean then to say that something's a person? And really dialoguing about what we are. We're seeing that particularly in movies. I mean, the movie Ex Machina, if you haven't seen it, I'd encourage you to watch it. It's a great movie. I think it won some awards, in fact, that it does a great job of bringing about this question, okay, is the Turing test good enough? Like, is that adequate? Or is there actually going to be something more to it? And the movie's about, well, I think it would need to be more than the Turing test.
Right.
And so, you know, it's interesting not to give away the movie, but self-preservation becomes a part of their test.
That also reminds me of the Chinese Room
thought experiment. Yeah, John Searle. Yeah, you should explain that because I think that's an important, you know, thought experiment to start to grapple with the complexity of the problem we're dealing with.
It actually kind of counters the Turing test. And basically what the Chinese room thought experiment says is, let's imagine there is a room and inside this room is a person, let's say a Westerner who doesn't know Chinese. He is locked in this room with a bunch of pieces of paper with these Chinese characters written on it. And then he has a book, a really thick book, manual of that tells him if you get this combination of Chinese letters, you should put out this combination of Chinese letters. Again, this person doesn't know Chinese, but he has this manual that tells him input-output kind of a thing. Now, a Chinese person comes along from outside the room. He writes something down on a piece of paper and slips it under the door. And the Westerner inside picks it up. Again, he doesn't know what this says, but he goes through his manual, finds the right combination, and the book says, the manual says, okay, you have this combination, put out this combination. So he collects the right pieces of Chinese characters, and he slips them under the door to the Chinese person. Now, the Chinese person outside the room picks up this combination of characters and he says, wow, this person knows Chinese. But again, this Westerner inside the room actually doesn't know. He just knows input output, but he did something to actually convince the person outside that he was Chinese.
Well, really, you could say that the person inside the room is just implementing a program.
Basically.
Right? And that's ultimately what we're seeing with code, is that code is a program and that those programs are being implemented by these computers.
They're blind, really.
Yeah, absolutely. But yet, it for some people, it can become convincing, oh, that this is a person or that this is conscious. I think about, you know, like, for example, the chatbots that we saw, there were a number of Donald ones that we had seen and mm-hmm. kind of played around with. Some were more advanced than others. Like the MIT one is fairly advanced.
Mm-hmm.
The one that you were reading was not advanced.
Yeah, that was just straight up code. Right?
Yeah, it was totally mm-hmm. random.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was another one, though, that we saw that would at least look for words that
right.
would correlate. So if you asked a North Korea question, it would look for quotes by Donald that he said North Korea in there,
mm-hmm.
and so that it was at least somewhat related. But this brings us to a major problem and a major challenge that we want to look at today as we think about this and the direction our culture is going and some challenges that we're going to be continuing to face. And that is, you know, it's one thing to implement a code in a conversation with an input output. But it's another challenge with think about how science operates, in which you want to know something, such as the cure for cancer,
mm-hmm.
right? Or you want to know what, let's imagine in the past you wanted to know why light bent around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Or if mass was capable of slowing down time, you know, mm-hmm. or you're raising one of these deep questions, you know, that ultimately, you know, people like Einstein, you know, came up with and ultimately, you know, came up with the theory of relativity mm-hmm. and general relativity. But how do we as people, I mean, this is a major question. How do we come up with these discoveries? You know, how do we mine for these answers where there's just not this input output? Like, how is it that we actually go and discover things about the world? I mean, could we build it? I mean, I think for a while there was this time where we thought we could just build a computer and you could just ask it questions like, what's the cure for cancer? Mm-hmm. And it's going to be able to, you know, discover that for you. But what we're realizing is, no, it in fact can't do that. That there is a quality that persons are capable of that is very unique. And this quality is personhood mm-hmm. in that we're able to ask questions, but we're also able to discover. We're able to do research. We're able to think mm-hmm. about things, even things that we can't put into words.
I wonder if that has in large part to do with free will. I remember seeing this this guy Tim Stratton. He's a biology grad. He put out what he called the free thinking argument, where he actually argued that naturalism has to be false because we seem to be exhibiting free will. And if you don't have free will, actually rationality is destroyed, and along with it, any pursuit of knowledge, including modern science, because if you want to have rationality, you have to be able to choose between ideas. You need to be able to deliberate on several ideas, and you pick what you believe is true, and other arguments or ideas that you know are false, right? So you have to be able to choose that way. But if you are completely determined, naturalistically determined, then
because that's the only other option.
Mm.
Is determinism, and which would then necessitate that everything that's occurred in this universe was determined in the initial explosion of the creation of the universe, or Big Bang, if you will, that everything was determined from that point on, and that there isn't any real discovery. It's just everything kind of unfolding.
Right.
And the only other option, of course, would be, though, that no, there's actually free will, and, mm-hmm. and this isn't just some sort of mechanical, physical mm-hmm. process that's unfolding, but I'm actually experiencing what the world, and I'm actually interacting with it.
Mm-hmm.
This is where an interesting thinker by the name of Michael Polanyi comes in, that, as many of you know, I've been doing research on, and I think that, he's an interesting character because he stumbled across a major problem early on, and this problem's only recently coming to light and gaining more and more exposure. And that is that we have a real problem in our post-Enlightenment culture on how we define what something is. Now, in our culture today, when we think about what a thing is, we will often apply a very reductive, what we would call a reductive ontology.
Right.
That to understand the existence, what something is, we will reduce it to what it's made of. Mm-hmm. Because in the secular worldview that our culture is currently operating by and large from, is the idea that if you've removed God, that's the secular idea, right? If you've mm-hmm. removed God from the universe, all that you have is this closed physical system. And that necessitates then that all the answers are within that closed physical system. So then what something is what it's made of. I mean, if you want to know, you know, fundamental reality, you reduce it to, you know, what it's physically made of, the mm-hmm. the hard stuff, if you will.
So in an atheistic universe, everything is reduced to matter and motion, basically, right? Matter and energy.
Exactly.
That's all it is.
Now, the challenge to that is, on an everyday level, we don't operate like that.
No.
For example, if I were to ask you, well, what's this machine that's on my wrist?
That's a watch.
Right. You would define it. Now, notice what you did there. You didn't define it by its parts. You didn't call this thing on my wrist a bunch of plastic, metal, and glass. Mm-hmm. You defined it by its purpose, by by its function. It's a watch. It has a purpose. Right. Now, that's fascinating, isn't it? In that here's a machine that was created for a purpose, and that's actually how we define what it is. I mean, it makes you even think about, okay, well, what actually then is a chatbot? What is this artificial intelligence? I mean, the fact that it's seeking to mimic to be a person, but then would that actually mean that it is a person? It raises the question, how are we to understand what a human being is? Mm-hmm. How are we to understand what a person is? What is our function? What's our purpose?
Yeah, and already right there, when you mentioned purpose, I'm thinking purpose has to have some kind of an intentionality there, right? Some kind of object-directedness. But intentionality is, again, a quality of persons. You know, a microphone doesn't have any intentions. It doesn't have intentionality. Same thing with my keys or any inanimate object.
So that's the problem, right, though?
Yeah,
because
you have to presuppose personhood.
Think about that for a moment, just to pause this conversation to go back to the idea of science. If we're just a purely physical universe, how on earth is science possible? If science is about discovery, it's requiring this free will, it's requiring this intentionality. So mm-hmm. that's one problem. That was Polanyi's issue, by the way, is he critiqued reductionism on the fact that it destroys persons and it destroys science in the process. And it's self-defeating. So ultimately, he kind of comes from a different perspective and says, no, we can't start from the physical world because that's by and large how the secular world works right now. You know, we work from the physical stuff towards ourselves. And Polanyi would say, no, you have to start with yourself and then you work towards the physical world to seek to understand it. And so he wrote a book called Personal Knowledge and created a philosophy in the category of epistemology that's based on personhood, which I think I'd love to talk more about. We're running out of time here, but from there is where he says no, everything's going to follow from personhood, discovery, you know, intentionality. But the question is, and that is something that we're wrestling with in our culture, if that's the case, if purpose, if we're going to define something by its purpose, which we naturally do every day, and particularly we do this with not individual parts, but by component parts, the purpose of a whole thing that's been intentionally put together for a purpose, we'll define as such. How then are we going to understand what a person is? And this is where Christian theology, I think, is so important. So Polanyi was a scientist, and out of his concern for science in this secularized, you know, post-Enlightenment culture, he moved into philosophy later in his life because he realized that philosophy needed to be have a better foundation if it's going to support science in the future. But now what we're seeing is if our philosophy and our science is going to be supported, we're going to have to move farther into theology. We're going to have to be able to develop some sort of foundation to understand ourselves. The problem is...
He wasn't a Christian, was he?
Well, that's a point of contention. At one point, he converted to Christianity, but some would say he did that during during the World War II so that he would avoid, Jewish... what's the word I'm looking for here?
so he wouldn't be taken away to
a
concentration camp or something like that.
Yeah. There's a word there that I can't remember.
It'll come back to you.
Yeah, that's great. So that's hard to say, but he was he was well read in Christian theology. He had read Tillich, for example. He was a big fan of Augustine. Mm.
That's a little contentious.
Yeah, okay. We're not quite sure what he believed. But ultimately, the problem is we didn't create ourselves. Mm-hmm. People didn't bring themselves into existence. How then are we going to, we can't give ourselves our purpose. We can't create for ourselves a function. Either we have one or we don't. Mm-hmm. And the question then becomes, well, where did that come from? Now, Christianity would say that you were created by a personal God. A God that created you for the purpose of relationship with Him and relationship with each other, and so then this becomes the foundation. You are a relational being, and so I think it's quite fascinating that we want to build things like chatbots or artificial intelligence, because ultimately that's the only way that we know how to relate with anything is on a relational basis. The problem is our attention constantly gets focused in other areas than where it should be. Mm. We focus on the natural world instead of the creator of the natural world.
Which is interesting because, just because you don't function in the way you were created, it doesn't make you a non-person, but the intended purpose actually becomes the objective standard by which to determine whether you're functioning properly or not.
Right, and for Polanyi, this was a huge thing, was, what does successful functioning look like? Because that's part of understanding what a thing is its success and its failure. And so isn't that interesting how that applies in Christianity to the success and failure of a person, as we would talk about with regards to sin? And here you have Jesus that comes along, the incarnate, right? God in the flesh, and he lives out perfectly what it looks like to be a person. He lives out successfully what it looked like to implement the purpose of right relationship with God and right relationship with each other.
Yeah. Preach it, Andy. Preach it. Well, thank you, listeners, for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you again next week with more.